Did you know that 70% of all books, including those traditionally published, are sold online via e-commerce? If you're an author wondering how you can get some of that market share, this is for you. Hi, I'm your co-host, Carly Waters, and I'm here to tell you how writers can work on their author brand and build an audience and convert those followers into book buyers. Ever wonder why so many authors publish books and later say that they didn't sell as many copies as they wanted? It happens over and over, and we see it all over social media. Authors think it's a them problem, but not always. They just weren't shown the way. And I don't want you guys to launch a book and show up at book events and have two people in the chairs. I've helped clients launch client books to the bestseller list for 15 years and have built a six-module, 11-hour course with all of my knowledge that will give you the craft and book business information that you simply won't find anywhere else. And there's an app plus monthly Q&A sessions with me. 200 of you have already joined my new course. And as writer Siobhan Moore said, I'm halfway through the course and grieving that I didn't have this information sooner. There's really nowhere else to find it. Worth every penny. If you want the info that will change the course of your writing career, go to carlywaters.com/course to learn more and use discount code POD15. That's POD15 at checkout. That's POD15 at checkout over at carlywaters.com/course. I'll see you there.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. I am so excited to share that I am teaching my super popular Hacking Writing on a Line Level class in November. And this time, it's a three-day event. We'll spend the first 2 days learning rules and techniques that will help you elevate your writing. And then the third day will be dedicated for Q&A. This class is filled with examples, and I mean it. All examples, all the time. So you will leave with an invaluable toolkit to hack your own writing on a line level. Check out the link in my bio on Instagram for more information. I hope to see you there.
Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Today's guest is the author of Boys and Girls Screaming, along with two self-published novels, Thoughts of a Fractured Soul and Beauty Scars. In addition to his writing, he's a filmmaker, teaches professional writing at a local college, and is committed to supporting emerging writers and helping them find their voice. He lives in Toronto. It's my pleasure to welcome Kern Carter. Kern, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here. I'm a fan, so I'm extra excited to be here.
Oh, that's so lovely. Thank you so much for saying that. And anyone who's committed to supporting emerging writers is someone that we love in return, because as you know, that's our commitment as well. So there's a lot that we're going to chat to Kern about today. The book that we're discussing is And Then There Was Us. I will read you the blurb copy shortly. But before we get to that, Kern, something I'd really like to discuss is how many different routes to publication there are, because we've sort of done surveys of our listeners and they tend to be more focused on traditional publishing. They want to get a big five deal. They want to publish with one of the big five, but there are so many different ways to publish through indies, through self-publishing as well. So it's not often that I get to speak to somebody who's moved on to traditional publishing after they've done the indie publishing. So I'd really love to pick your brain in terms of the different experiences you've had with that, perhaps the pros and the cons and what you've learned from that whole experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do feel fortunate because I've had all experiences. I self-published my first two books. My first published book was with an indie publisher. And then now I'm published with Dre, who is part of Penguin Random House and Scholastic. So I've kind of been on all parts of the journey. I think for me, the biggest difference really is about understanding every part of the publishing industry. Like when you self-publish, you're forced to understand every single part of the industry. You market yourself, you put your money in yourself. But I'll be completely honest though, Bianca, the leap from self-publishing to traditional publishing, it was not as like far. It wasn't as long of a leap as I thought it would be. So I still do a lot of my own promotions. I don't put as much money in, for sure. That part has been completely amazing. Also working with a team when you have a publisher, working with a team and having them being able to send out emails, having them be able to put you into bookstores that you're not able to connect with, having them to really expand your reach, that has been absolutely incredible. Getting me into festivals that, you know, that either I didn't know about or I couldn't get into myself, that has been phenomenal. But as far as the amount of work that I do to really promote myself and to, you know, market my own book and to talk about my own book, that part has changed very little. Like, I still do a lot of that work myself. I set up my own book signings at Indigo, which is our Canadian bookstore up here. I do a lot of the promo myself. There's a lot of things. I'm putting money into advertising myself. So I'm an author with a larger publisher, yes, but I'm not like their top author at the same time. So it's not like I'm getting all of the attention and all of the special treatment that would come with being part of a top publisher. So the leap has been, there's a difference for sure, but it's not, maybe it's not as far as a gap as people think.
Yeah, I love everything you've said there and 100% agree with it. You know, I think sometimes writers think, oh, you get a big five and it means that everything happens for you and you sit back and you kind of count your money, which is definitely not how it works. Because yeah, there are lead titles, you know, you'll be coming out at the same time as other authors at your own publisher, and you seeing money being thrown at their campaigns, and you kind of look at your campaign and you're like, okay, clearly not a lead title, etc. And yeah, as authors, we are expected to do a ton of marketing, do book clubs, do outreach, do everything we can to promote our work in conjunction with our publisher, who's obviously doing everything they can to promote the book. But there are so many books that come out at the same time across the world every single week that it's difficult for your book to be the one that stands out. So of course, you need to be your book's greatest champion. In terms of the first book that you self-published, I think that was about 10 years ago, if I'm not mistaken. So I mean, it's been 10 years and you've come a long way in that time. Do you feel like you as a writer, when you look at your work now, do you feel like the work is better now? Do you feel like you have evolved as a writer when you look back at the self-published work? Or do you honestly feel that it was perhaps just a particular book that grabbed a traditional publisher's attention in terms of why you are now being traditionally published? Or did you not want to even consider that back then? Is it the case if you got an agent now and you didn't have the agent back then? I'm just trying to understand the 10-year difference between where you are now and where you were then.
That's a great question. And I have so much to say about this. First of all, no, when I look back at my books now, there is a huge difference in the way that I write. The biggest difference I think that has gotten me to where I am today is because I've really committed myself to learning and learning the craft and studying the craft very specifically. And I have to actually thank an agent for that. I'll tell you a very quick story. I went to New York. After my first two self-published books, I was like, okay, I want to be published now. So I knew the first step was to go get an agent. So I went to New York and they had this, like, it's almost like speed dating with agents. You know, you sit in front of an agent for like 5 minutes and you get to do your pitch for a few minutes. So I sat with, I think, 5 or 6 agents. All 5 of them said, yes, they liked my pitch. Send them my full manuscript. I went back home. I was excited. I was like, you know, telling all my daughter and my friends, I'm like, yes, I just need one to say yes. I just need one to say yes. This is in a bag. You know, I'm about to be published. All of them said no. Every single one of them said no. One of them, for whatever reason, Bianca, gave me feedback and detailed feedback. Like, this is what you're doing wrong. This is wrong. This is wrong. You're writing this wrong. You're showing, not telling here. Like, super, super detailed feedback. And at first I was almost offended because I was like, wait, I have 2 books out already. What do you mean? Like, this is wrong. Like, I know show, don't tell. I know blah, blah, blah. Like, I was like, this is almost insulting. I felt insulted at first. But then, like, very quickly after I got over that kind of anger, I was like, wait a second. If this agent took time to tell me all these flaws, she's telling me this for a reason, you know, and she must be right. So immediately, that happened in, let's say, in about November of that year. I think it was 2018. January of 2019, I enrolled myself into a novel writing course. 2 semesters, 8 months, full-time novel writing course. And I had one-on-one, basically it was like one-on-one with a published author, and they workshop your book. So I did that for 8 months. The book I was workshopping was Boys and Girls Screaming. And my writing improved over those 8 months more drastically than at any other point in my career. I understood writing from so many different levels after that. I almost felt like embarrassed before, because I was like, wait a second, like, that's how many things I did not know about writing, you know, writing novels very specifically. So once those 8 months were done, I put myself into another like shorter course after that. But it was really those 8 months that got me to where I believe that really helped elevate my writing. And once I got that, we workshop Boys and Girls Screaming. I pitched it to an agent. They read it the same day, sent me the contract the next day, and then we were off. We got a publishing deal within a month. Like, it was so fast. So the craft, the studying of my craft has really, really, really helped me. And I continue to learn today. I've taken two of Cece's courses just over the last 6 months, right? So I took her line editing course and I took her tension course. So I continue to learn every single day. So that's the learning is one thing. The other thing is with Boys and Girls Screaming, what I also learned because I studied the industry as well, not just the craft, I studied the industry. I wrote that book very specifically to be a YA commercial fiction book. You know, like that was my intention. I wasn't just writing a novel because I'd want to write about this or whatever I had in my mind before. I was like, I'm writing a commercial fiction novel, right? Like, and it was very, very deliberate. So it helped inform a lot of the decisions I had to make. It helped inform who the characters were. It helped inform how I decided the plot would go. It helped inform so many decisions for me. So those two things, studying the craft and being very intentional about the type of book that I was writing, which means I had to understand the industry, those two things really, really helped me excel and help me get to where I am today. Then, I mean, after that, it was almost like floodgates. I have 4 publishing deals right now. So it was after that, it became somewhat, I don't want to say easy because I know people listening to this would feel like, no, it's not. But it became easier after you get one, it's easier to get another one. So
I love all of that. There's so much to break down there. One is the constant learning. I mean, I'm about to publish my 4th book, 5 if you include my Audible original, and I'm still constantly learning. I will still see something from Cece's course that I'm like, oh my word, I never thought about it that way. Or I'll chat to an author on the podcast who frames something in a way and I'm like, oh my word, something has just clicked into place and now I understand it in a way that I never did. And I feel like if we care about the craft and if we are committed to becoming better writers, we should constantly be opening ourselves up to learning opportunities. There are writers that I'll speak to, even emerging authors who aren't yet published, and it'll be like, well, maybe, you know, you can learn from this. And they'll be like, oh, no, I know everything already. And I don't care what sphere you're operating in, whether it's business, whether it's medicine, whether it's writing, I don't believe you know everything already. So I'm always suspicious of that outlook. So I love your outlook. 2, the agent feedback. You know, when you have one agent who sees your potential, because that's clearly what the agent did. The agent saw your potential, saw your hunger, saw your eagerness to publish and was like, you know what, I'm going to give you this gift that in the moment did not feel like a gift, but afterwards was a definite gift. And something that freaked me out is in the last week or so on Twitter, I've seen some agents say that they are stopping giving personalized feedback because in the space of 1 week, they got 4 abusive responses to their personalized feedback that they meant to be helpful. Now, Kern, help me out here. How does an author do this?
I have no... That is wild to me. I just told you the story about how I took the feedback and I understand the initial emotional response for sure. Like, it's your work, no matter what you're writing, fiction, nonfiction, memoir, doesn't matter. You're going to feel connected to it. But to take feedback and to spin it in a way that feels negative and get abusive, no, I would never in my life and even entertain that. And to be honest, why as an author would you do that? Agents actually don't have to give you feedback. That's not their job. Their job is to say yes or no. Right? Like, I like this or I don't like this. That's their job. That's they get hundreds, good agents or popular agents get hundreds a week, maybe even more. So why, if they take the time to actually give you personalized feedback, would you ever in your life question that, you know, or flip that into something that you turn into abuse? Like, I honestly can't relate to that. That doesn't make sense to me.
I was the same. When I saw this, I was just like exploding head emojis. You know, so few agents take the time these days to give personalized feedback purely because they have so many submissions and so much coming at them and they just really don't have the time. And then when they give a gift like this and then an author turns around and is like, you don't know what you're talking about. You're stupid. My work's great or whatever. It's just writers don't do that. Yes, you feel the sting. Every time you get critique, it stings. You know why it stings? Because you invested in your work, you invested in your characters. You've spent a long time on it. And so the feedback and the critique can feel personal, but it really is a gift. So take yourself away from the situation, really let it percolate and come back to it. I also love what you've said about the intentionality, because it is so important for authors to be intentional. That was what I did with my third book. I was like, okay, I wrote two kind of more literary book clubbish novels that didn't do that well. I'm going to write something very commercial, and this is who I'm aiming to submit it to, and this is who I'm aiming as my target audience. And that was the one book that broke through and then, you know, reached Canadian bestseller lists, which my other books hadn't done before. So it is important to sit down and be intentional with what it is you're trying to achieve. Now, let's talk about the book. And then there was us. So I'm going to read our listeners the flap copy. After years of physical and verbal abuse from her mother, 14-year-old Koi moved in with her father, and together they created a peaceful life. But now, 4 years later, that peace is shattered when her mother dies soon after reaching out to Koi. While Koi struggles to find kindness in her heart for the woman who did nothing but hurt her, her mother's passing does help reopen the door to her mother's side of the family. It's only through reconnecting with her estranged family members, especially her younger half-sister, Kayla, that Koi's long-held beliefs about her mother are challenged. And when Koi begins to see visions of her mother in her dreams, she's forced to ask herself what it means to forgive and be forgiven, and most importantly, what it means to be a family. So this was an incredible, heart-wrenching read. Really, really sucker punch in the stomach, kind of tears in your eyes. Read really just hit all the notes. Firstly, I'd like to ask, I mean, you're a man writing from a teenage girl's perspective. What were the challenges of that? And why was it so important to you that Koi be a female character as opposed to writing a teenage boy's perspective? Again, in terms of intentionality.
Yeah, good question. So I'll actually take it back to my agent again. My agent is actually really phenomenal. I've been blessed, to be honest. After Boys and Girls Screaming, my agent said, you know, because Boys and Girls Screaming goes back and forth between a young girl and a young boy. So he's like, you write young female characters really well. You should think about writing an entire book from that perspective. And I had always wanted to tell the story of my daughter. So this book is actually very close to my daughter's life and what we went through. You know, like there's parts of it, lots of it obviously is made up and is not real. But the core of the story, the 5-year estrangement, the way Koi kind of behaves and stuff like that, a lot of that is pulled from real life. So for me, I know it seems like it might seem like a leap when people are reading it, like I'm a man, I'm writing from a teenage girl's perspective. I had full custody of my daughter. I lived with my daughter for forever. She lived with me every single day. So I had that voice in my head. I listened to how she spoke. I listened to how she spoke to her friends. Me and her had conversations very specifically about this book because I knew it was personal. So I actually asked her permission if she's okay with me writing this book. And then she told me more stories that she never told me before that actually made its way into the book. So I think I have a little bit of a knack for just kind of capturing that female voice. So I think part of it is natural. I was raised by a lot of women, so maybe that also helps. I did have a little bit of a cheat code. I had my daughter with me, and she was a teenager. At the time I was writing this book, she was Koi's age. You know, she was literally her age. So it wasn't difficult for me, to be honest. I felt so normal writing it. I wrote this novel faster than I've written any novel in my life. A first draft, faster than I've written any novel in my life, because first of all, the story was very personal. And second of all, I heard Koi's voice every day. And it was like, I could literally close my eyes and know exactly what Koi sounds like. I didn't have to think about it. I didn't even have to do any research. You know what I mean? Like, other than speaking to my daughter. So it was very natural for me. It wasn't that much of a big deal.
After spending our summer vacation this year in Europe, it opened my eyes and my kids' eyes to the power of language and finding common ground no matter who we are and where we are. One of the most important things to me as a parent of two is making sure my kids see other places in the world and are exposed to the languages they speak around the globe. They're in French immersion education, and I'm honestly already getting left behind. I took French class in school until grade 9, and I have a big gap in my learning that I'm ready to fill. And that's why I rely on Rosetta Stone, the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, and it truly immerses you in the languages that you want to learn. I know my kids' language learning skills are going to explode past me, and I'm ready to catch them, and that's why we have Rosetta Stone. It's a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users in 25 languages offered. We're talking Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and many, many more. There is fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways. There are no English translations, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. There's an intuitive process. You're picking up a language naturally, first with words and then with phrases and then sentences, and it is designed for long-term retention. There is speech recognition technology. It is called True Accent. It is built in. It's a feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. It's convenient. There is super flexible learning anytime, anywhere. Learn on the go with a mobile app or on your desktop at your schedule. There is amazing value because you have lifetime membership for all 25 languages for any and all trips and languages that you need in life. That is a steal. That is 25 language courses from Rosetta Stone that they offer it for 50% off. So don't put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. So go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
Fantasy writers, I hope you'll be joining me for the All About Fantasy full-day virtual retreat on the 28th of September from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you write YA fantasy, romantasy, adult fantasy, epic fantasy, cozy fantasy, dystopian fiction, or any other variation of the genre, you won't want to miss out on this amazing day of learning dedicated especially to you and those writing in your genre. The lineup includes award-winning and best-selling authors, as well as literary agents and editors who specialize in the genre. You'll have an opportunity to submit your query letter for critique. The Story Engine, who is sponsoring the retreat, is also hosting an awesome giveaway of an All Things Fantasy storytelling package that contains a copy of each of their decks, Story Engine Deck and Deck of Worlds, each with their associated fantasy expansions, the mythology, dystopian, and fairy tale boosters, valued at $237. All delegates will also receive discounts when shopping on the Story Engine website. Come and learn, ask questions, and even more importantly, build community. To find out more and to register, go to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the All About Fantasy tab. I hope to see you there. Yeah, my next question was going to be about how you approach characterization, because she felt so fully formed. She was like a real character. She jumped off the page. And so that answers that question entirely. And for our listeners, you know, drawing from real life, whether it's just elements of a person's experience, whether it's a lot of the experience, really adds that specificity and that like flavor of plausibility and realness to a story that really makes a character come alive. And in this instance, it really did that. And it's so important how you approach characterization in terms of what they want, in terms of what they're going after, in terms of the stakes, in terms of their wants and needs, and the emotionality informs the whole plot, as opposed to the plot informs how they behave. And this is so much with Koi. It's, you can see the mistakes that she's making. You can see her resistance to things. You can see that there are times that she should be visiting her mom in the hospital and she just doesn't want to. There's a lot of resistance there. And it informs so much of what happens on the page in terms of her personality, in terms of her trauma, her inherited trauma. So it all feels very, very cohesive. Let's talk about the importance of naming a character. I find that this is sometimes the hardest part of all, is really coming up with a name for a character that you feel encapsulates their essence. How did you approach the naming of yours?
Yeah, that's interesting. I had no idea what to name Koi at the beginning. And then I was watching TV. So this is so random. I was just watching TV and someone was talking and they're like, they said the word Koi. And I was like, you know, I'm like, that for some reason it just resonated. And when I thought about the character, I was like, that's the name. Literally, like in that second, I was just like, that's the name. And then it just started making sense with her personality and whatnot. And kind of to what you were saying before, I actually start with emotion. I need to know the emotional journey that the character is going to go through before anything, before plot, before whatever. Like, what emotional journey is this character going to go through? And for Koi, it's actually fairly simple. She's angry. You know, Koi is someone who is, she thinks she's over her mother. She's not, you know, she thinks she could be independent and move on and do all this stuff. But Koi is just someone who is really angry because she's dealt with a lot of trauma and she hasn't been able to let that go. So I think the naming of it has to deal with her emotions because it's almost like a play on words because she's actually not very Koi at all. She's actually very honest, very straight up. She'll tell you exactly how she feels. She will do things in spite of everyone else telling her to do the other thing. So I think it was that once I understood the emotion of where she was going, I thought it would be kind of a cool play on words to make her name Koi and have that be like counter to her personality.
Yeah, I loved the name, loved it. And, you know, something you said there is what a lot of YA authors write well is teenage anger and angst and sort of the rage, etc. Because there's a lot of being powerless with being a teenager. You know, there's so much that is out of your control. You're growing into yourself, but you still don't have a lot of control over decisions, etc. But something that you did especially well was to write a kind of numbness. It's almost an emotional limbo. There's this freezing of emotions in which a teenager either has gotten to the point where they have stopped themselves from feeling as a self-preservation mechanism, or they just don't have the language to describe how they are feeling in that moment. And that was something that I don't see in a lot of YA that you did especially well. So again, was that coming from conversations with your daughter? Was it a case of really studying like the trauma response in terms of teenagers and this getting to the point where just stopping yourself from feeling anything because feelings are so incredibly overwhelming?
Yeah, so that part actually wasn't from conversations. And thank you for saying that, because that's something I really focus on in the novel. So I'm happy you picked up on that. That was me being very aware of the character themselves, of Koi herself. And once I was fully, fully aware of who she was and who she is, I understood that that numbness was going to be a huge part of how she operated in the world, you know? And the numbness is, I don't want to say fake. That's the wrong way to put it. But it's almost like a front. It's really something that she puts on so that she could protect herself from her true feelings. Because if she let out her true feelings, then it would be too much for her. It would overwhelm her totally. So that part was just me being kind of being a writer, let's just say, you know, like being an actual writer and thinking about the character and understanding the character deeply, understanding the emotions deeply, and then being able to create that feeling of separation from her true emotions and her doing that for pretty much the entire book. Like she's like this throughout. So I'm really happy you picked up on that because I was really trying to create that.
Yeah, it felt like a very authentic coping mechanism for a very traumatized child, you know, which was incredibly written. So let's talk about the super, almost supernatural elements of the book. You know, she has these conversations with her mother that happened through dreams, and you know, there's this realistic element to it, and you're like, are these things really happening? Are they not happening? Is she psychic? Is she not psychic? Was this something that was planned from the beginning of the book? Was it something that evolved as you were writing as a sort of plot element? I'm always interested to see how much writers sit down beforehand and go, this is how it's going to be, this is what I'm factoring in, and how something will develop purely because we're not sure how to relay that information, especially since Koi is written in the first person, as so much YA is. And the problem with the first person, especially when she's in the future, is that she does not have access to things that happened in the past. And if she's not speaking to her mother and her mother's in a coma, her mother can't tell her these things. And they weren't speaking in the past, so she didn't have access to this information. So for example, with my debut novel, I created, well, spoilers here, but if you haven't read my debut yet, you're probably not. So I created an imaginary twin sister who for the first part of the book, you think is her real twin sister. And then you find out she's imaginary. And that part came from the fact that I was writing a 10-year-old girl who did not have the language to explain how she was feeling and to process what she was feeling. And so she projected all the time, all these negative things onto an imaginary twin. So that only came much later in the evolution of the novel. So in terms of the supernatural elements, how did that evolve for you?
Yeah, great question. Actually, it was from the very beginning. The book, when I first drafted it, the dreams were everything. I had like a dozen dream segments in there. I had a lot. And then once it got to Penguin, the editors there were really, really strong about removing a lot of the dream elements, because what they saw was that the dream elements were taking away from building Koi's character. We weren't able to fully see who Koi was or fully develop Koi's character if she was constantly in dreams speaking to her mom. So we dwindled all the way down. I think there are only 3 or 4 dreams left in the final version of the novel. But my initial kind of thought process was that the entire novel was full of dreams, and Koi was pretty much only dealing with everything through her dreams, you know? And there's a back and forth with editors that authors go through. And I'm someone who's very careful with my writing and very, like, I think all authors are very protective with their writing. But me, I am protective with my writing, but at the same time, I just gave trust to my editors. I just said, let me start with trust and go from there. And so I trusted them. When they said, take out all these dream segments, that was like hard, because again, my initial thought process was, no, the entire book is supposed to be this, feel like this dream. Like, that's how I was thinking about it. I want this entire book to feel like a dream. They're like, no, the book is about Koi. Like, let's make the book about her and just use the dream elements to add to that, to add to who she is. And when they showed me how we could do that, I was like, oh my gosh, you're so right. And I'm so thankful for them. And I'm also happy that I listened, because they always suggested things. It wasn't like they're like, you have to take it out. They're like, this is what you should do, and this is why I think you should do it, you know, and this is the benefit of you doing it. So I was very open to that. But this was editing. It was total editing. I had a whole different view of what the novel could be or what the novel should be. And then my editors were like, no, like, you're actually diminishing Koi's character. Let's focus on Koi and let her deal with things in real life. And I think the book is way, way, way better for it. I can't even think about that first version.
Yeah, those of you who've listened to the podcast know that Carly and Cece, when it comes to critiquing sort of opening pages, are not fans of dream sequences. They are just like, no, take out the dream sequences. We don't like it, etc. And I think a lot of editors feel the same way. So for those of you who are working on dream sequences that kind of move the plot forward, where a dream acts as a catalyst to engage in a conversation that reveals things and moves the plot forward, and you're trying to figure out how to do that, definitely get this book to see how it was done. And 100% agree. You need to trust your agent. You need to trust your editors, and it needs to be a collaborative process. And there will be times that you're like resistant to it and you go, I'm not so sure. And then you'll think about it and you'll go, yes. And then there'll be times that you get suggestions and you are just like, hell no, maybe it's not working right now, but how am I going to fix it so that it works down the line? So it's important to trust them, but it's also important to trust your gut as well. Right. We are running out of time, Kern. So I have 2 questions. One, I want to ask how being a filmmaker influences your writing. And then I want to discuss some of those future projects that you say you've got coming up.
Filmmaking, writing scripts is so much different than writing novels. I don't even think I can compare it. When you're writing scripts, it's pretty much only dialogue with very few, you know, anything else. So it's not comparable. I'm still in the early stages of learning how to put together scripts. You know, it's like, I was fortunate, yes, that one of my films did well. But the first script that I have right now that ended up, you know, it's on Prime Video right now, called Wallflower. I didn't write that script. I helped edit that script and help co-create the story. My creative partner wrote that script. So for me, the filmmaking process is, the writing of it is different, and the entire process is far more collaborative. There are so many more people involved in making a film. It is actually kind of, it's bonkers being on a film set with 50 people every day, and so many of them have an opinion on set. They will change things about the writing on set, you know, because the director saw something or the DP saw something. They're like, no, let's do this. And they should come in from here. And then you're on set and you have to change it on set. So it's not, to me, it's not comparable. They're 2 very different experiences. I enjoy it, though. It's something I enjoy. We're doing really well. Wallflower is doing incredibly well for the first film that we've ever created. So we're very proud of that, very proud of it. I know my partner, my writing partner, is extremely proud of what she did. But as far as like it helping me with anything with writing or it connecting to my novel writing, there's 0. I don't get anything from it, to be honest.
And in terms of your upcoming project?
Yeah, so I do have 1 novel coming out in October. That's a middle grade book. And I never wanted to write for middle grade, to be completely honest with you. But Scholastic reached out to me, which is, again, I feel very blessed and very fortunate. Scholastic reached out to me and they said, hey, you know, we love the way you write. Would you be willing to write a middle grade book? And I'm like, because I didn't understand children's books before. So I was like, no, I don't really, you know, that's not my thing. But they're like, no, you could still write a novel, but we're writing it just right geared for middle grade. So I was like, okay. And they gave me a topic that they were thinking about. And I was like, all right, let me come up with some ideas. I came up with some ideas. They loved one. It's called Is There a Boy Like Me? So that one's coming out in October 1st, actually, which I'm super excited about. It's kind of like, I didn't even know, I think I really did this subconsciously. This book ended up being a lot about my younger life, you know, like me growing up as a middle grader. And I didn't intend to do that. I was really writing a story about toxic masculinity. That's what I was writing about. But it ended up just being very close to my life. So that's coming out October 1st. And then, I mean, I'm working on so many other books right now. I have one that really eager to pitch to my agent. I'm actually a little bit nervous to pitch to him because it's just like so far from what we've been doing before. And I don't know how he's going to feel about it because it's not YA. But yeah, I have a few things coming out. Is There a Boy Like Me, though? That's the one that I think that my agent is definitely most excited about. The Scholastic is super, super excited about. They think it's going to do really well. This is new for me, so I'm just sitting back like, hey, whatever happens, happens, you know, but I'm enjoying it. I honestly love being an author. I feel very privileged to be able to write stories. Yeah, I'm living a dream, you know, to be completely real with you. I really do feel like I'm living a dream. I'm one of those writers who, I wanted to be an author when I was 8. I wrote my first book when I was 8 years old. This is a lifelong thing. I didn't fall into it. It's not an accident. I didn't like say, oh, let me try this out. This is what I wanted to do for my entire life. So I literally feel like I'm living a dream every day. And I'm not, you know, I haven't sold millions of books yet, but at the same time, just the opportunity to do what I'm doing, having the opportunity to reach, you know, right now, thousands of people and tens of thousands of people. And with the goal and the aim of reaching millions of people, I feel very fortunate. So I'm soaking it all in.
I love it. And I'm tempted to leave it there, but I know our listeners are going to yell at me if I don't get the name of your agent. So firstly, I'm going to ask the name of your agent. And then secondly, also for our listeners, because I saw this question on Twitter the other day as well. They were like, published authors, do you just write a book and then afterwards show it to your agent? Or do you pitch ideas to your agent first and see what they like and then work in conjunction with them? It's different for every single author. I know some authors who will write the whole book and then put it in front of their agent. And if the agents don't like it, well, then tough. For myself, I sort of pitch ideas to CC. I'll send her a first few chapters and say, this is what I'm working on, what do you think? And she'll be like, eh, or she'll be like, oh, I really like this one, because I just hate wasting time and I'm not prepared to write a whole novel that she's not going to like and doesn't think she can sell. So just in terms of your working relationship with your agent, Kern, and their name as well for our listeners, please.
Yes, so my agent's name is Chris Casuccio. After the first book, so I did have to write the first full book, obviously, like that's kind of how it worked. But after that, no, I pitch him ideas. I don't want to go through writing. Like, he's my agent. He's selling it. So if he's not behind it, then we're not going to do it. I'll do something else with that book. You know, maybe I'll publish it myself, self-publish it myself one day. But we're working together. And like I said, he's been very supportive. He's very honest with me. If something is not working, he tells me. We changed, like before we sent And Then There Was Us to our publisher, he actually told me to go rewrite this entire part. Like, you know, so we changed, like Koi's age was different before. He's like, no, you need to change your age and do this. And I rewrote the entire thing. So I trust my agent fully. He's been great. Again, he's the one who gave me the idea to write in a young female voice in the first place, because he saw that I was actually really good at that. So no, I trust him fully. So I pitch him ideas. Like I'll write like a chapter or something out and then tell him like what I'm thinking. But if he's not feeling it, then we're not moving forward with it. And then also too, he tells me how we're going to move forward with it. I had this idea for this like book that's totally experimental. And he loved the idea, but he's like, this is so experimental. Let's not go wide like we normally would. Let's just try a few publishers, get some feedback and see what happens. So he's great. I have no, not even that I have no issues. I feel, again, very privileged and lucky, because I have heard stories where authors are like, oh, my agent doesn't get back to me, and my agent this and my agent that. I don't have that problem. My agent messages me right away and he's on me for things. So I love it. He's great.
Kern, it's been an absolute joy chatting with you. Thank you so much for taking the time. For our listeners, we are linking to And Then There Was Us on our bookshop.org affiliate page. Watch out as well for Kern's middle grade that's coming out in October. And we hope to have you back again soon. Thank you, Kern.
Absolutely. I love it. I'll be listening. So I'll be here either way.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamarais.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. I am so excited to share that I am teaching my super popular Hacking Writing on a Line Level class in November. And this time, it's a 3-day event. We'll spend the first 2 days learning rules and techniques that will help you elevate your writing. And then the third day will be dedicated for Q&A. This class is filled with examples, and I mean it, all examples all the time. So you will leave with an invaluable toolkit to hack your own writing on a line level. Check out the link in my bio on Instagram for more information. I hope to see you there.